It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We explore the expansion of food distribution projects for Wisconsin First Nations at the intersection of food sovereignty in tribal nations. The Tribal Elder Food Box Program, it is providing thousands of meals to tribal elders in the 11 federally recognized tribes in Wisconsin. Join in on this program, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Kara Black is Fresh Category Procurement Coordinator for Feeding America Eastern Wisconsin. Kara, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Hi, Kate. Thank you.
Yes. And Gary Bisaw is here, director of the Menominee Tribal Department of Agriculture and Food Systems and the Menominee Tribal Food Distribution Department. Gary, welcome back.
Yes. Welcome yourself. We appreciate you inviting us back in. And good morning.
Good morning. Yes, Gary, let's start with you. Why is a targeted program like the Tribal Elder Food Box Program, why is that needed in Wisconsin?
Well, for several reasons. During the pandemic, when the pandemic started, we saw that the COVID-19 had really impacted our tribal elders. We have such a high prevalence of on many of the tribal reservations, the prevalence of diabetes, high blood pressure, heart disease, shortened lifespan, poverty, and we saw that the impact of COVID to the individuals, to our elders, they were so susceptible to this, and we saw that there needed to be foods as medicine in working with our elders, because we saw that the food boxes during the pandemic, remember how terrible that looked, seeing all of the milk poured down drains and we saw all of the food spoiling in the fields because the hotels, the restaurants, the schools were not procuring that food because they were closed. So they looked at sending that food then in food boxes. USDA purchased that AMS and sent it out to food banks across the United States.
The Farmers to Families Food Box Program. Mm-hmm.
Yes, exactly. And lo and behold, many of those types of food for our elders were more processed, or they were dairy products, and many of our tribal members are lactose intolerant. So we start looking at those foods, and a lot of our elders said, as much as we appreciate these boxes we're getting, we can't eat a lot of this food. So that consternation then was, how do we look at getting food that we know our elders can eat, that's culturally relevant for them, and under the whole guise of food as medicine, how do we do that? Mm-hmm. And that's how this was started, in that search for funding or a system to get this type of food to elders.
Kara, take us into the procurement aspect and what makes this program different from other food assistance programs.
Right. So this program is so different. And I think what sets it apart so much is the intentionality behind every part of the program. So there's intentionality in who we buy food from specifically. So I work really, really closely with now 16 Indigenous producers across Wisconsin, one in Minnesota, and one in Michigan at this moment. Two in Michigan. And what that means is I spend hours working with each producer, trying to make sure we have operational cost, market pricing, that everything is very fair for them, making sure that they can make a benefit off of the product that they're selling to us. We look for a variety of products. As Gary mentioned, we look for culturally relevant foods. So that's specific in what produce items, what protein, as well as what shelf stables. And we're really, really grateful this year to be able to provide shelf stables as the first year the funding didn't allow for that kind of purchasing. So now we're able to provide items like jams, apple butter, maple syrup, maple sugar candies. We'll have granulated maple sugar soon, wild rice. All of these products are really emotional support foods, as Gary has told me, to our elders. And so it's really important that we're able to get these foods out. And so again, I just circle back to the intentionality between and behind every single thing that we do, every product that we order, every person that we work with. 16 native producers, we're sourcing out of the funding that we have right now, 60% of it is coming from native producers. And that's just a huge win for all of us. We want to see that be 100%, and we can get into how we can make that happen someday.
I'm going to reintroduce both of you as we talk about this program that supplies locally sourced food to tribal elders around Wisconsin. Kara Black there. Kara is Fresh Category Procurement Coordinator for Feeding America Eastern Wisconsin. And Gary Besaw is here. Gary overseeing the Menominee Tribal Food Distribution Department. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Gary, do tribal elders need to register to get these boxes, or how do they become part of the program?
What we've done is, initially, in the first year that we did this in 2021, we had tribal elders showing, and for this program, tribal elders need to show proof that they are 55 years or older. And initially, they showed their tribal ID, so we could indeed make sure that we are working with those tribal elders. And there is no income requirement for this, so nothing can make you ineligible for this. We knew that diabetes and some of the other health impurities do not necessarily follow income guidelines. We know that a lot of this, we wanted to get into the hands of our valued elders. So we took any kind of funding requirement out, and we let them know, this is for you because you are one of our valued elders. And that took the stigma away from people coming into a food distribution program, where before somebody might think, well, people are going to look at me differently because of my income bracket. But with this, it had nothing to do with income. We wanted to make sure our elders had that food, as we view food as medicine.
Kara, how far do people travel for these boxes? How are they distributed?
That's a great question, and it's something we're actively looking into. We are actually creating a survey right now to send out in the last few boxes of this season so that we can try and get an estimate, because right now we know there are at least a few, like a handful of elders who are traveling from Milwaukee County all the way up to Oneida each distribution to get boxes. And that's just, we just happen to know that from our partner over at Oneida. So we're hoping to get a gauge on how far people are traveling, because that could, you know, in the future, if we're looking at different distributions, where can we expand to, that might help us get a gauge on. I know we all know we need urban distributions, but maybe where, and just how we can better place ourselves to serve the greater community.
And as you work with these 19 Indigenous producers, food producers, how do you think about supply chain issues and inflation and what economic pressures that they may be facing and feeling as you try to put these boxes together?
Right. That's a great question. And it's 16 at the moment, hopefully more in the future.
But, I think I was counting Michigan and Minnesota as part of the family.
Okay. No, but that is a huge, great question. So right now, we know that our native producers, many of them are small but mighty, I will add, but they are facing issues of inflation of, you know, pricing of boxes, pricing of packaging materials, trucking. A lot of our folks don't have trucking vehicles, refrigerated vans, freezer vans for protein items. There's even troubles getting into butchers right now. I mean, that's been going on for years, but just getting a scheduled butcher appointment to get the meat processed is a huge barrier at the moment. And so these are all things that we're working on. We have great partners all over the state. One in particular is the Wisconsin Food Hub Cooperative. And they have a food hub located in Waupaca, which is a pretty centralized area in Wisconsin. And so they have trucks that they allow us to use, freezer and cooler space. And so we work with them a whole bunch to make sure that our producers, if they have meat processed but don't have a place to store it, that we can go pick it up right away and get those supply chain logistics worked out. But that is a huge thing we lean on with our partnerships. We also just, I mean, I spend a lot of time on the phone and in person with these producers, making sure that the prices we're setting for their products are accounting for the various gas building, price of getting of help harvesting, all these things.
So those escalating inputs.
Exactly. Yeah. We make sure that what we're paying the producer is actually beneficial to them. So that price may look different than it looks from our conventional growers or our other small local growers. It definitely is usually higher for our indigenous producers, especially because, I mean, the products that they're putting forth, the shelf stables, like our maple sugar, the wild rice, these things are all being hand harvested. They're being wood fired. It's traditional ways of harvesting. And so we need to make sure not to put a dollar value to that, but making sure that they're getting compensated for that incredibly, incredibly hard work.
Labor intensive. Yes. Mm-hmm. Kara Black is a procurement coordinator for Feeding America Eastern Wisconsin. Gary Bisa here leads the Menominee Tribal Department of Agriculture and Food Systems and the Food Distribution Program for the Menominee. You can join in on Native Producers and this Food Box Program, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent as we explore the Tribal Elder Food Box Program at work in Indigenous communities in Wisconsin, with the contents focused on food produced by local Indigenous growers and harvesters, each box providing roughly 4 meals for an elder. Join in on this program, how you see it working, what questions you have, 800-642-1234. We have Kara Black, who's in procurement at Feeding America Eastern Wisconsin, and Gary Bisa, who's director of the Menominee Tribal Department of Agriculture and Food Systems and leads food distribution for the Menominee. Gary, the Food Box Program is one of several efforts to improve agricultural and economic development for Wisconsin First Nations, and you've been involved in this project that allows tribes to take over control of eligible federal government programs. Why do you see food sovereignty really vital for tribal nations?
One of the things that we've seen is that with the fluctuations in climate and weather conditions, that we need a resilient shortened food chain. We need to close that down and not depend on the other sides of America for this, because many times in the past we've seen that happen with other energy sources as well as food. So we know, just as USDA and others have looked at developing shorter, more resilient types of food systems, that needs to happen. And we also understand that we need to also model reducing our carbon footprint by shortening how far those products need to be shipped across the United States. But we also know that tribal nations want to do their part, and we are looking at developing a green economy. And with that, that means looking at the sustainability of the types of foods and how we grow the food. And with that, our elders have always said, food is medicine, and we need to make sure we're not putting a lot of the herbicides and pesticides into those food. So we understand this type of system has to happen. So I think all of the partners we're working with, like Wisconsin Food Hub Cooperative, University of Madison, Health Tide, Feeding Wisconsin, Feeding America, Eastern Wisconsin, and others. We have a great coordinated team. And the idea is we want to understand that whole food acquisition cycle, the aggregation, the transport, and the distribution system, with the hope that we can then develop that and create a Wisconsin intertribal agricultural cooperative to get some sustainability into this. Now, that said, we also, through the 2018 Farm Bill, the Native Farm Bill Coalition had pushed, and these include many, many tribes across America, had pushed in the Farm Bill to allow control, at least we wanted it permanent, but at least in a pilot status, for our food distribution programs to be able to exercise control in supplanting or replacing certain foods that already are in the food system or on the shelves in our food distribution programs. So since we did get that provision into the Farm Bill, now we can contract with FNS, the Food Nutrition Services, under USDA. So if we were receiving, for instance, buffalo burger or hamburger or beef roasts, that we were getting them and AMS was purchasing them wherever they purchased them, we can go in and say, we want to replace those same foods with us being the vendor, us purchasing those foods, and we want to purchase it from indigenous vendors. We can shorten the food chain because we know Wisconsin producers for those, and we can buy from indigenous producers and help support and build those green economies from our tribal producers. So that is in a pilot phase right now, and there are 7 of those pilot programs through food distribution programs right now. And one of those happens to be Menominee and Oneida in a joint effort at providing and replacing certain foods on the shelves of our food distribution program. So the goals are very similar
and
we have with our elder food box.
Yes, and making multiple impacts. I'm wondering, what feedback do you get from elders on these boxes? What do they tell you?
Elders tell us, number one, and I mentioned some of that before, that they can't praise it enough, because they're getting foods now that they know, that they recognize, that they have that relationship with. They know how to cook them, and they know that this is food that is raised without those pesticides and herbicides, and the food is clean. They know that, and under that guise of food as medicine, they love it.
Kara, we only have less than a minute left, but what are your future goals for the Tribal Elder Food Box Program? What do you hope to see?
Well, really quick, I'll just add this quote to that last question. I have, from our last survey, receiving this food from other nations, from tribal producers, was appreciated and made me as an elder feel like I was being looked after and loved. It made me feel happy. That one really sits with me. And so as we look to the future, we know that we need to expand to urban sites, Milwaukee, Madison, Green Bay. We're looking for multi-year funding to be able to do contracted growing with some of our producers, letting them know that forward contracting that there is a guaranteed market, that we are going to buy a set amount from them, maybe a set amount plus some throughout the season, so that they're not wondering week to week what we're going to have available, what we're going to need. And then also hoping, yeah, so again, providing that guarantee to producers while expanding distribution is our goal. And then, as Gary mentioned, maybe in the near future, being able to build an intertribal food cooperative to put all of that into the hands of this team, being able to maybe have a distribution center that's tribally run and operated with, we're looking into logistical options, all these things.
Lots of things on the table.
Lots of things on the table, but that's the goal.
Yes, thank you both for joining us. Kara Black there, Fresh Category Procurement Coordinator for Feeding America Eastern Wisconsin. Gary Bisa, Director of the Menominee Tribal Department of Agriculture and Food Systems. For disclosure, Feeding America Eastern Wisconsin is a business sponsor of WPR. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Less than 3 weeks to the midterm election, we focus on a Senate race that could determine which party controls the Senate. Republican Ron Johnson is seeking his third term in the upper chamber. He faces Lieutenant Governor Mandela Barnes, whom we spoke with Tuesday in this space. Senator Johnson, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Morning, Kate. Hope you're doing well.
I am doing well. Let's start with inflation that is causing a lot of Wisconsinites not to do well. The latest Marquette Law School poll found the top concern among registered voters here in our state is inflation. So if you're reelected, what would you do to address inflation?
Well, first you need to understand exactly what caused inflation. And as my favorite economist, Milton Friedman, always said, inflation always and everywhere is a monetary phenomenon. But in addition to the massive deficit spending, which prompted the printing of all this money, so you have way too many dollars chasing too few goods, Democrats also declared war on fossil fuels and purposefully drove up the cost of gasoline and energy just in general. Of course, energy, gasoline, diesel, that's a component to every product and service that you're using as well. So that also fueled inflation. So the partisan $1.9 trillion COVID relief package, much of that isn't even spent till as far out as 2028, sparked the inflation. And so the way to get it under control is, first of all, open up the spigots. Let's become energy independent again so that we can bring down the cost of gasoline in a genuine way, as opposed to what President Biden's doing right now, which is risking our national security by depleting our strategic petroleum reserve.
Well, let me
And we need to dramatically reduce deficit spending, and I have a record of having courage to vote against these massive deficit spending bills.
Well, what about corporate profits? Because, you know, you mentioned BP, ExxonMobil recording record levels of profitability while people are in this cost of living crisis. How would you propose controlling profit price inflation? Do you think these surging corporate profits are forcing us to pay significantly more for goods?
The cost of energy that the consumer pays is dictated far more in terms of the supply and demand equation. And when supply is reduced, demand remains high, prices go up. So the oil company profit component of what people pay at the gas pump is probably less than what you're paying because of state and federal gasoline tax as well. So,
well, let me ask you this.
You can rail on corporate profits, but it's really profits that drive companies to invest in things like drilling so we actually have oil so we can power our economy.
Well, business profitability, it rose to a record high, $2 trillion in the second quarter. You don't think cracking down on record high corporate profits would do anything to cool prices in our country?
First of all, you just said that oil profit worth $2 trillion in the second quarter?
I said business profitability. That's the Commerce Department said business profitability rose to a record high, $2 trillion in the second quarter.
Our economy is only $23, $24 trillion large. I think you just incorrected that figure. But anyway, let's move on to We're not going to agree on this.
Okay, well, let's bring in Natasha in Oshkosh with a question on inflation. Natasha, go ahead.
Hi, good morning. My question is, since inflation is the biggest issue facing most Wisconsin families, what's the most significant difference between you and Mandela Barnes and how you plan to address the rising costs?
Well, once again, you know, Mandela Barnes has been for all of the Biden administration policies that caused and sparked inflation, the massive deficit spending, the war on fossil fuels, which, again, is the main driver of dramatic increases in gasoline prices. People have to understand, they purposely drove the cost of gasoline up because they wanted to force you into an electric vehicle. So the solution would be become energy independent, allow oil producers to drill for oil so we have adequate supply to meet demand that would bring down prices and dramatically reduce, if not end, the deficit spending, which provided all these dollars chasing too few goods.
Natasha, thank you. So you mentioned deficit spending, and you've regularly raised concern during your career about our country's deficit and our debt. Why is this issue important to you?
Because inflation is crushing everybody. A dollar that you held at the start of the Biden administration is only worth 88.3 cents now. And inflation, like I say, it crushes everybody, but it's particularly harmful to people at the lower end of the income spectrum or seniors on a fixed income. If you're fortunate enough, for example, as a senior to have a $100,000 nest egg, I'll use that just for ease of calculation, that $100,000 is only worth $88,300 now. In addition to that, the stock market has declined dramatically because Biden's policies have also put us into negative economic growth. And if you want a component of a solution to any problem, the number one component is economic growth. We have to grow our economy, but you have to know how to do it. You don't do it by overregulating. You don't do it by overtaxing. You don't do it by demonizing entrepreneurs who are just trying to produce products and services that we all value and produce good paying jobs and, you know, while you're doing that. So I have a background in the private sector. I ran a manufacturing plant for 30 years. I exported plastic to China. I created good-paying manufacturing jobs. I have that lifetime experience versus my opponent that has little to no experience, work experience
so
in the private
sector
whatsoever.
I'm trying to understand, so with the deficit, difference. What would you try to change in order to get the spending cuts you desire?
Well, first of all, stop spending money on things that we can't afford. For example, in this latest Inflation Reduction Act, which was very Orwellian name, there's not a economic think tank that thinks this bill will actually reduce inflation. I think it will exacerbate it. But one of the things they spent money on was $369 billion on the Green New Deal energy boondoggles. That'll be corporate welfare. It won't stop climate change. It will put money in the pockets of people like Al Gore, though. That's $369 billion that we can't afford that will further spark inflation. So I would first rescind that spending.
During the Trump administration, you supported the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act. The Congressional Budget Office estimates the law added $1 to $2 trillion to the national debt. Why didn't you raise alarm bells about the deficit when supporting those tax cuts?
Because you need a competitive tax system to grow your economy. We had a record economy prior to the COVID recession. Those tax cuts were well on the way for paying for themselves before the COVID recession. And so, again, it's spending is the problem, not overtaxing our economy. So you have to have competitive tax systems. You have to have a reasonable regulatory environment so businesses have the incentive to invest and create good-paying jobs and products and services that we all value. Again, I understand how the private sector works. My opponent has never worked in the private sector, has no idea how an economy works. And I think it's pretty obvious that the Democrats in control have no clue either, because they took an economy that should just be roaring at this point in time with low inflation, and they turned us into negative growth with high inflation.
One more question.
Again, your listeners have to ask themselves, better or worse off 2 years into the Biden administration? We're dramatically worse off.
One more question on deficit before we move on, Senator. Social Security and Medicare are the two largest mandatory expenditures not negotiated each year by Congress. Would you put those entitlement programs on the chopping block? Would you try to change the age eligibility or to reduce those programs?
No, I've never said that, by the way. I want to save Social Security. I want to save Medicare. And I'm just pointing out that the greatest threat to any government program, including those which are high priority programs, is the massive deficit spending. The Social Security Trust Fund runs out somewhere in the range of 2033 to 2035. Right now, we already pay out more in benefits than we're receiving the payroll tax. So we're starting to deplete the trust fund, which, you know, pretty much is just an accounting gimmick that when the trustees go to the Treasury to refund those bonds or cash those in, the Treasury just issues more bonds and has to borrow more money. So the question is, will we have the financial wherewithal in 2035 to plus up Social Security benefits to the promised levels? I want to ensure that we can do that. So I'm trying to save Social Security. I'm trying to save Medicare. And the way you have to do that is you have to start prioritizing spending. You can't waste money on things like the Green New Deal, energy boondoggle. We just don't have the $369 billion.
Would you want Congress to renegotiate those programs each year?
What I want Congress to do is to dramatically reduce deficit spending and start prioritizing top priorities would be Social Security, Medicare, and defense. But we can't afford things like the Green New Deal energy boondoggles. We just can't.
It'll have
no impact on climate change whatsoever, but it puts at risk Social Security and Medicare.
We have Republican Senator Ron Johnson on his reelection bid. We just heard from John in Ellsworth, and you mentioned climate change, and John called in, couldn't stay with us. John is very concerned about the warming planet. What is your stance on climate change? And he asks, why are we ceding solar panel production to China?
Well, first of all, I've never denied climate change. The climate has always changed. It always will. I'm just not a climate change alarmist. I'm more of an adherent to what Bjorn Lomborg talks about in terms of when you have limited resources, there are better ways of alleviating human suffering than wasting it on things like the Green New Deal energy boondoggles. Solar panels, that's a real problem with that, isn't it? I mean, we're relying on China to produce solar panels. I'm for an all-of-the-above energy policy, solar, wind, all of it. But if you're concerned about climate change, what you ought to be supporting is nuclear. And environmentalists won't allow us to do that. So we are a fossil fuel-based economy. We will be one for decades. China and India are not going to give up their fossil fuel-burning power plants. So we could eliminate all CO2 in America. And even by the environmentalists' own models, that wouldn't change climate change by even a full degree. So it's a fantasy to think that we can impact climate change by spending hundreds of billions, if not trillions of dollars. We just shouldn't do it because it's mortgaging our children's future and putting at risk Social Security and Medicare. It makes no sense.
Incumbent two-term Senator Ron Johnson of Wisconsin seeking a third term in the Senate. We talked with his Democratic rival Mandela Barnes on Tuesday here. Join in 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Wisconsin has a pivotal U.S. Senate race, one of a number being closely watched as Democrats try to hold on to the majority and Republicans aim to tip the balance of power in the chamber. We talk with incumbent U.S. Senator Ron Johnson, who faces Democratic rival Lieutenant Governor Mandela Barnes in the November 8th election. And Senator Johnson stays with us. We talked with Barnes on Tuesday. Let's talk crime for a moment. The New York Times reports murder and violent crime increased nationwide in the past 2 years. And this year, violent crime has fallen while property crime is on the rise. What should Congress do to address crime?
Well, first of all, at every level of government, you have to realize the top priority of those governments is to provide safety and security. So on a national basis, that's making sure we have a strong national defense, that we secure our borders so we don't have a flood of illegal immigrants, like almost a million known or known gotaways. I mean, who knows who's coming into this country that could threaten us within that flow, a flow of deadly drugs poisoning our cities. On a local level, you have to support law enforcement, and I have done so. My opponent hasn't. He's been pretty hostile to police. He says that he doesn't use the word defund, use the code words. He wants to reallocate over bloated police budgets. He says he pains him to see a fully funded police budget. And now we find out that six times as a state legislator, he went on Russia Today.
Well, okay, I want to pause there because Mandela Barnes was on our show this week and elsewhere has repeatedly insisted he did not and does not support defunding the police. But I want you to speak to your solutions for public safety. How do you solve the root causes of crime?
Kate, that's what Mandela Barnes says, but he's not being honest. He's always supported defund. And when he went on Russia Today TV six times, including a few days after the Dallas police shooting, where we lost five law enforcement officers, he went on Russia Today, and he basically rationalized that shooting. He said that police are over-exercising their badges, turned their badges into a license to bully, and specifically talking about that police shooting, he said it was probably a retaliatory attack.
So
he allowed himself to be a propaganda tool of Vladimir Putin. So, again, it starts with Kate. It starts with supporting law enforcement. And it supports with fully funding law enforcement efforts. That is primarily a state and local effort when it comes to policing our streets. And at a national level, it's called securing the border, which I have always been in favor of. It was my Operation Safe Return that morphed into Return to Mexico. We pretty well had the border secure until President Biden got into office and the Democrats opened up the border. That puts our safety and security at risk as well. So, again, it's about strong national defense, homeland security, securing our border, fully funding and supporting local law enforcement. I'm for that. Lieutenant Governor Mandela Barnes is not, and he has a record of rhetoric and demagoguery against police. He seems to be more sympathetic with the criminals. And let's face it, 884 criminals paroled under Governor Evers and Mandela Barnes. 784 violent, including 44 child rapists.
I want to get
270 criminals who either primarily committed, or attempted murder, and they were horrific murders. So the records are quite clear here, Kate.
Okay, so Mike from Hudson called and couldn't stay with us, and Mike is concerned about guns. How will you regulate guns and the purchase of guns? And by the way, Mike says they are an avid hunter.
So, Kate, there are more than 10,000 gun control laws on the books throughout America. If gun control was the solution, we wouldn't have crime, would we? But unfortunately, we don't enforce those gun control laws. In 2017, I think there were 112,000 background checks that failed, and yet we only prosecuted 12 of those.
The Bipartisan Safer Communities Act would have addressed that, and you voted no for that.
I doubt it would have, okay? Again, we pass law upon law upon law, and it doesn't fix the problem. You want to reduce violence and crime, the overall macro solution is renewed faith, stronger families, more supportive communities. So many of our laws, some of our welfare benefits break up families, don't allow a father to be present. Let's take a look at what we need to do to strengthen
families. But what does that have to do with guns? I mean, your no vote.
No, guns are not the problem. It's the individuals who use the guns. And you have to take a look at what's happening to our society where violence has become so rampant. My opponent says that police don't prevent crime. Yes, they do. So it's a completely different attitude. I support law enforcement. We want more law enforcement officers. The problem with the whole defund police movement effort is that it dispirits police. It causes police to back off. They're not able to police the way they were trained or the way they want to. And it's very difficult to recruit. We're down 1,000 police officers in Wisconsin. We're having a very difficult time filling the positions because of the dispiriting nature of the defund police movement, which Mandela Barnes has absolutely been supportive of. No matter what he says.
Let's move on to abortion now. Let's move on to abortion now. Let's go to Amanda in Madison. Amanda, hi. What's on your mind?
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. Appreciate it. I just had a question about the standpoint from just like why is abortion and why are women's reproductive rights even a topic in politics. And then also just to quickly add from a listener and voter perspective, it is quite difficult to parse out what the guest and Kate and what you are saying. So I'd appreciate some separation there. Thanks.
Amanda, thank you. Go ahead, Senator Johnson.
Well, I agree with Justice Alito when he said abortion is a profound moral issue. And it's been a divisive issue for 50 years. Nine justices making this decision for everybody didn't solve the problem. So what I'm looking forward to is having a thorough, thoughtful, compassionate discussion. And then what I've recommended is a process where we can finally come up with a consensus to so it allows us to move beyond this, okay? And so what I've recommended is a one-time single-issue referendum that asks the question, at what point does society have a responsibility to protect the life of an unborn child? And that would be balancing the rights of a mother with the rights of an unborn child. The extreme position here is that an unborn child has no rights whatsoever, and people that want to allow abortion up to the point, the moment of birth, and that's what, of course, my opponent wants. That's what Democrats in the Senate voted for. It was no limitations on abortion whatsoever.
Why should abortion be subject to a popular vote?
I want we the people to decide that. In that situation with one referendum, I would have one vote along with the millions of Wisconsinites who would also go to the polls. I have a sample ballot on wisfacts.com. All my thoughts on this are detailed out there, but my sample ballot has 10 choices. At what point does society have the responsibility to protect life from the moment of conception all the way to the moment of birth? And you choose at what point do you think life should be protected? And again, I think we have to have a thoughtful discussion, understand what life looks like inside the womb at all those stages, and as abhorrent as it might be.
So there shouldn't be federal legislation that some sort of minimum standard.
Also, we should understand what abortion looks like at each stage of pregnancy as well. So again, that's where we need a thoughtful, thorough, and compassionate discussion on this issue. But I'm trying to come up with a process where the vast majority of Americans will accept the results and we can move on and address, for example, the mortgaging of our children's future.
So I just want to make clear, there shouldn't be any type of federal legislation that sets some sort of minimum standard on abortion that you would support, because Lindsey Graham, your colleague, had a bill that, you know, banning abortion after 15 weeks.
Yeah, at this point, I don't want nine justices deciding this. I don't want 535 members of Congress or 132 members of the Wisconsin legislature. I want we the people deciding this for society in single-issue referendums where we ask that question, at what point does society have the responsibility to protect life of an unborn child? And I think at some point in time, we have that responsibility. But I want society to decide that, not elected members of this is such an important issue that's been so divisive for 50 years. This is a process that I've recommended that I think will decide this question so we can move on to other very difficult issues.
Senator Johnson, thank you for joining us.
Thank you. Have a great day.
You too. Ron Johnson is a Republican U.S. Senator running for his third term, faces Lieutenant Governor Mandela Barnes, a Democrat, in the November election. Quick disclosure, we offered both candidates equal airtime this week to discuss their campaigns. Lieutenant Governor Barnes accepted a shorter time than we offered. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.